Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. We are more than a little happy to have you be with us. I realized that yesterday we got some notes on this, and I just personally felt like, well, yesterday's show was kind of a downer, and so we're just the crew here. We're all trying to pump ourselves up and say we're just going to have a great show. We're going to be fun. We're going to be in good moods. We're going to go through everything. It's a Friday. We're going to be excited. Right, panel? Everyone's on it?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, that's exactly. That. I knew it wouldn't take long, Judith. All right. Let us begin, and we welcome all of our wonderful panelists. I will introduce them in just a moment. I first want to extend an invitation to you so that you can join us and be part of our conversation. We love to have you chime in and tell us what you're thinking about what is going on in our world. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, my friend. How are you?
Well, good morning, Joe. I'm fine. It's Friday, and Fridays are great days because they offer a promise of a weekend. However, I've been thinking lately that weekends aren't what they used to be, right? Because a lot of us are in our homes. We're there, you know, so the sense of change from workday to weekend day is a little bit strange. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. No, I think part of it is because you think of the weekend as the time that you're going to do those sort of mundane chores that you normally don't have time for. But now if you are working from home, you find that you do have time for those. So when Saturday comes and you think that you have to take out the garbage and do all that stuff, you've already done it.
And Joe, just one other thing. I know I'm taking too much of my introductory time, but starting next week, we're going to the lockbox. We're doing it because we cannot stay alive without it. For all of you who admire this program and the great work that Joe Donahue has been doing here and making all of this happen, this is the time you really put something in and go to WAMC.org. It's going to happen. We could do it in a single day, and we wouldn't lose a moment of the program. We could do it in a day. We know that, and we know we will do it. But friends, there's no question that all over America, people, public radio stations are in real trouble. We've never been there ourselves, but we could be. We could be. And anybody wants to put a challenge in or do anything to help out, this would be a great time to do it. You call the radio station at 1-800-323-9262, and you talk to Amber Sickles, and she'll help you out, and she'll tell you what you have to do. Anything you can do to help. We are in desperate shape, and I say that because right now we are way behind the eight ball, so let's move it. Let's go.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's we can't have a normal fund drive like we do and we have for years and years. We can't have all of our wonderful volunteers in one room together and we all of that stuff that maybe in July or June when we thought we could June, I guess, when we thought we could we'd be done and maybe could get back to normal in the fall. Well, we can't. So here we are and we have to do everything that we can do. And so during the roundtable panel in the mornings from 9 to 10:45-ish, we're going to raise the money. We're still going to talk about issues. We're still going to talk about what's going on. But yes, we're going to also try to fill the lockbox and get to, we'll give you numbers and everything on Monday of it's the same, it's the $1 million and that's what we have to raise. And we'll give you totals of what we have in there so far. But yeah, it's very important that we keep it going. And if, as Alan said, challenges really work, are wonderful, and they're a lifeline. And just when you think you're not going to be able to do it and make the money in the morning, then all of a sudden somebody comes in with a challenge and it saves the day. So if you can do that and help us with $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever, all you have to do is call us and talk to Amber Sickles or just go to WAMC.org and they'll direct you to the right place.
We can do this. I know. And we could do it. And Joe, and one more thing.
Yes.
We could really do it in a single day. You know, I don't want to hear anybody complaining because if everybody were to do something, we'd be done in a day. One day. We've done it before. We could do it.
Well, Yes. And you know, the thing is that I don't think any of us, we had no idea what to expect in June when we did our fund drive. We had no idea. We're doing it in the middle of a pandemic. We're still doing it in the middle of a pandemic. And we had no idea how it was going to go. And what surprised, I think, all of us was that, I mean, it shouldn't have been a surprise that we asked you and you delivered, which is really not that big of a surprise. But the rapidity, I mean, we didn't even have, we made it in much less time than we ever, what was it, 2.5 weeks, Alan, I think?
Yeah, something like that. We gave ourselves, I think we gave ourselves a month and we did it real quick.
Yeah, in half that time.
Because everybody loves the station.
So we have, so we're giving ourselves that month, and look, we're just going to keep going until we make it. That's what we have to do. But the sooner we do it, the sooner we get back to talking about all of the things and doing all the things that we need to do, especially as we come up in this all-important election. So it all began on Monday morning. We'll be ready. We'll tell you all kinds of good stuff on Monday. But whatever you can do now, and if you want to get in early and clear your conscience and put that on your list, as Alan said, weekends are different. So if you have a little extra time, maybe you could do that too. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. All right.
We do have volunteers. We do have staff members who can answer a phone, but we don't have that many of them, Joe. So the main thing is, if you can, go to WAMC.org. That's the way we're going to save the station.
That's right. And we'll begin on Monday and do all of that, but anything you can do in the meantime is certainly will be accepted. Let's put it that way. All right. Let's introduce everybody, and we'll get started. We got the important information out there. Judith Enck is with us, senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Jennifer Burns is here, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning, everyone.
Wonderful to have you here as always. And our good buddy Aaron Pasitti is here, Siena College economics professor. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning. I would like to ask, who was the intro music? I was really enjoying that.
It's the performers from their album Ocean Garage.
Okay.
And if you want to write it down, all you have to do is go to our website. Our playlist is always posted there, wamc.org/roundtable. All right. Help me get in one of my plugs there, Aaron. It's as if we planned it. Good morning, everyone. Let us start and talk about what's making news. And as I said, we're going to try to be a little more upbeat today than maybe we were yesterday. So let's talk about it's an impossible task, but we'll give it a shot. Let's talk about CDC testing guidelines. This is a story from the New York Times. A controversial guideline saying people without COVID-19 symptoms didn't need to get tested for the virus came from HHS officials and skipped the CDC's scientific review process. It's a heavily criticized recommendation from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last month about who should be tested for the coronavirus. Well, it wasn't written by the CDC. It wasn't written by scientists. It was posted to the agency's website despite their serious objections, according to several people familiar with the matter, as well as internal documents obtained by the New York Times. The guidance said it was not necessary to test people without symptoms of COVID-19, even if they had been exposed to the virus. It came at a time when public health experts were pushing for more testing rather than less. And administration officials told the Times that the document was a CDC product and had been revised with input from the agency's director, Dr. Robert Redfield. But officials told the Times this week that the Department of Health and Human Services did the rewriting and then dropped it into the CDC's public website, flouting the agency's strict scientific review process. That was a doc that came from the top down, from the HHS and the task force, said a federal official with knowledge of the matter. That policy does not reflect what many people at the CDC feel should be the policy. The document contains, quote, elementary errors, such as referring to testing for COVID-19 as opposed to testing for the virus that causes it, and recommendations inconsistent with the CDC's stance that market to anyone in the know as not having been written by the agency's scientists, according to a senior CDC scientist who spoke on the condition of anonymity. So it's as if someone who didn't know what they were talking about was writing it, i.e., a non-scientist. Alan?
Well, okay, I don't get it. I've never gotten it. The president has the ability to save lives. He goes in exactly the opposite direction. We know the more testing that goes on, the safer people are going to be. Because if you're tested and you're positive, then we can reach out and find out who you've been in contact and what's and what your relationships with them are. And they could be warned and they can be tested. And that is a good way to put a hold on the disease. I don't see what Trump, because it's clearly Trump and his philosophy. It's as if you were hiding, you're an ostrich and you're hiding your head in the sand and you're saying, it's not happening, it's not happening. If I say it's not happening, but it is happening. And the fact is that this guy, this president, is killing people, which is why I referred to him as being evil the other day, because he is evil. If you are not protecting the people that who you are sworn to protect, where are you and where are we? So I don't get it. I don't see what he gets out of this. But somehow, if he's pretending that if there are fewer deaths and there are fewer people, he'll be in better shape electorally. It's disgusting.
Well, and I want to go to Judith, but also that whole idea that. In that very, we touched on this yesterday, but on that very odd graphic that he posted during his briefing on Wednesday, odd/disturbing graphic that basically showed of how great a job that he would have done if it wasn't for those pesky blue states, but they were the ones, the Democratic blue states, were the ones that were causing all the trouble. Judith.
Well, there are such profound implications for putting policies out that don't go through the typical CDC review process. And the implications are, before we go to sleep tonight, we're going to pass the mark of 200,000 Americans dying from COVID. And 6.7 million Americans today have COVID. So this is just astonishing. And it is getting worse. The New York Times article also referenced that the CDC changed their recommendation on reopening of schools. Magically, someone gets access to the CDC website and drops documents that the CDC doctors have not had an opportunity to review. I would guess that the guy who resigned for 60 days, Caputo, probably had something to do with this. And it's just heartbreaking and it's tragic. And it reminds all of us that, you know, federal agencies doing their jobs matter, science matters. And it's consistent with the president's position on climate change. It's consistent with the Department of Labor not enforcing labor standards. I mean, he is really assaulting science and is hell-bent on making sure that the career scientists do not get to do their jobs. I will say that I'm disappointed that some of these career scientists don't speak out more and that they don't speak out on the record when lives are at stake like this. I know they don't want to risk losing their jobs, but sometimes things are more important. And when this policy first came out, we all knew it didn't make sense. But it's taking weeks for the truth to come out. And, you know, they should just have a buddy system where, like, every week someone is going to go out and tell the truth. Because this is, you know, people die because of mismanagement like this.
You know, I don't want to. You're absolutely right, Judith. By the end of the day, most likely we'll be at 200,000 deaths in this country. Just to zoom out a little bit, we also learned overnight that the worldwide count of known COVID infections climbed past 30 million. And more than half of that is from three countries, the U.S., India, and Brazil. So these numbers are huge, and it is it's very concerning, especially when things like this are being done to downplay something that is so enormous.
Jennifer, Joe, one other thing,
go ahead.
If I can, very quickly.
Of course.
Let me just say that the one myth that has been around is that it's over. It's not going to happen anymore. We're having fewer incidences. But now we know that when a school opens up and the kids go back and they start to talk to each other, they get infected. We see this all the time now. And we see in England, for example, they may have to go into another lockdown. So this ain't over. And anybody who thinks it is has got another thing coming.
Yeah, absolutely. And look at the rising numbers in Europe that are happening and that could or could not be a second wave. And that's deeply troubling, especially knowing that the time frame usually is that they're just a few weeks ahead of us. Aaron Pasitti, go ahead.
So, yeah, I mean, one, this is not surprising. This is part of the a very well-established playbook in terms of using the government as an arm to extend his own political fortunes. The scary part is now he is using American lives as currency in terms of getting himself reelected. He flip-flopped on masks, which seems to be the least costly, both in terms of public health expenditure.
Hey, Aaron. I wasn't looking at the clock. I lost all track of time. So I'm going to take a break and then come back.
Sure.
And then we're going to pretend like you're just going to start from scratch. We'll do that right after this.
Okay.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Jennifer Burns, and Aaron Pasitti. We were just about to get to Aaron and ask him what he makes of the CDC story. Go, Aaron.
So, this is not terribly surprising given Trump's record on politicizing, previously independent and apolitical arms of the government. The scary part is that he's using American lives as currency to get votes. The fewer tests there are, the fewer confirmed cases there are, the better the pandemic looks coming up to the November election. I mean, and that's a horrific thing to say that we have in 2020 a president who's willing to essentially sacrifice, tens of thousands of American lives, if not more, between now and November so that he gets reelected. And I think that's telling of his personality and his overall contempt for anybody who's not on his side or anybody who's not part of his family. So that's the kind of the personal self-interest to take on this. But I think there's a bigger story to this, and that's been part of the Republican playbook really since the late 70s and early 1980s, and that is, do everything you can to diminish the public's faith in the credibility of government, whether it's economic policy, whether it's health policy, whether it's environmental policy. The more you can make government policy seem ineffective, whether it's by sabotage or not, the more political capital Republicans have to ram through market-based reforms and ignore a lot of the, red flags and alarms that people are throwing up about, the coming environmental catastrophe, the coming economic catastrophe, the coming public health catastrophe. So it's important not to confuse what Trump's doing as something that's simply Trumpian, but part of a larger Republican playbook. And I think that's why you see a lot of Republicans staying silent on this. I mean, you would think that there is, a couple hundred, Republicans in Congress who would say, all right, this has crossed the line. But they're willing to bite their tongue and they are just willing to go along with it because it feeds an anti-government mentality or philosophy to governing. So it's obviously bad policy. The scary part is that lives are at stake now, and nobody, including sane members of the Republican Party, and there still are some, who are not speaking up and saying this is absolutely preposterous and absolutely catastrophic for the public health response.
Jennifer Burns.
I wish I was as talented as Dave Chappelle to be able to bring some of the comedy and have this be less scary and depressing. However, I'm not that talented. And so I will say that, you know, it seems to me that this is very clear. Like Judith says, it has Caputo written all over it. It has, you know, like Aaron says, the Republican playbook written all over it. And the Republican Party is in danger, and they know it. And that should not be part of the conversation, but it is. It is shaping and undermining the ability of people who are trying to be accountable and responsible when it comes to health decisions and safety. Because if you go to the website and you read this information, you are just fed falsehoods that are endangering yourself and others. And the other thing is, you know, this also helps to mask the major economic and racial disparities that are the outcome from people who are dying from this. And we know that that is happening. Mm-hmm. And by creating this mess of confusion and lies, it helps to mask and hide those disparities that the Trump administration is obsessed with denying and hiding, because it goes along with their rhetoric that racism is not real or that it will disappear, right? So this is appalling. And all Americans, regardless of what party you affiliate yourself with, should be up in arms about it.
And this is the question that we've been asking for the last 4 years of where is the opposition on these outrageous acts, and especially amongst the Republican lawmakers. And I can assume, Alan, if we haven't seen it by now, we're probably not going to see it.
Well, you know, the other thing about this is it allows people to sort of, we'll say, forget or overlook that there's going to be long-term lingering effects from this illness. And we're seeing that already happen, right? Mm-hmm. We're seeing the heart conditions and other things that are developing, you know, from people who've had the virus and have gotten over it, but are still affected in these other ways. And so by encouraging this fast, rapid spread of the virus, that is going to also be compounded later in health issues for people while we're still dismantling, not we personally, but while there's a dismantling and a changing of, you know, healthcare in America.
Hmm.
You know, Joe, in response to your question, you were right. We know from when the primaries were occurring and people were giving it both barrels, Republicans were giving it both barrels to Trump, that they have nothing but contempt for the guy. You know that when they're going home, they say to their spouses, isn't this terrible? This guy's such a jerk. We know that because we've heard it from some Democrats who've said they've spoken to the Republicans, and that's what they're being told. And yet, the issue here is just we are on a precipice of totalitarianism, and these guys are willing to live with it. They're willing to say, okay, my job is more important, and my loyalty and my longevity in my job is more important than anything else. And Jennifer is exactly right on this. This is a terrible moment in American history, and it's going to be recorded that way.
Mm.
And these members of Congress are just such cowards. And I think some of them have played this wrong. I mean, they're afraid of criticizing these deadly policies because they don't want to be tweeted at by Trump. But you look at some of these tight Senate races, for instance, I read this morning that in Lindsey Graham's race, he's tied with Jamie Harrison, according to a Quinnipiac poll. So, you know, and I think it's pretty clear Susan Collins is going bye-bye, and Cory Gardner's in trouble, North Carolina, Tom Tillis is in trouble, Joni Ernst is in trouble. So ultimately, they may have lost their seats anyway, But along the way, they lose their integrity and their dignity.
That's a great point. And I guess they don't care.
Well, they played it wrong. They think that they've overthought this politically. Rather than just standing up for the best interest of their constituents, they hid from Trump, and in the end, many of them may lose.
You know, Judith, just look at what happened to Jeff Sessions. He got creamed. There is no way out for them. So you're right, and Jennifer's right. The issue here is whether or not they and their families can stand up and say, I did right, even though it was clearly going to cost me, because there is no right way. When you said they played it wrong, I don't know how they play it. If they go against the president, they lose their seats, a la Sessions. If they don't, they've done the wrong thing. It is a puzzle to me that people can look in the mirror after they've behaved this way.
All right, we go to some letters here before we take a break in just a moment or two. Robert writes and says, some years ago, in anticipation of a difficult election, the Cubans volunteered to come and monitor our election. Maybe it's time to ask them to do it again in 2020. This is only somewhat tongue-in-cheek. We go to Thomas and says, the panel did not make yesterday a bummer. The facts can't be changed. The past 3 years and 8 months have been an exhausting bummer in America, filled with chaos, drama, division, and lies. The world has been void of compassionate, intelligent, wise, experienced American leadership for far too long. It's a sentiment that's echoed by Kathy, who says, I have to say that Lindell Erby's admission yesterday gave me a lift. I've been feeling much the same, and it helped to know that there are other people I admire, who are feeling the same. I have to thank you for yesterday's panel discussion. Alan?
Yeah, you know, that's right. Half jokingly, we said when we began today, we're going to be upbeat today, no matter what, because we were too. Well, you know, the answer is, we then started on the stories of the day, and every one of them.
No, they're crushing. No, they are. They are.
Every one of them was terrible. But here's the thing. We have to stay. We have to fight. We have to hold our heads up. And we can't give in to this. We can't give in to the clearly warranted depression that so many people are going under, because if you do, they win. It's that simple.
And I think the two words that we heard yesterday was depression, which is real. I mean, I think that's real. The anxiety and the depression and the panic that people are feeling is very, very real. The other thing, too, though, of course, is the sense of just exhaustion, just that every day it's another barrage. And especially now that we're in the run-up to how many days, Judith, till the election?
46 days.
46 days till the election. That in that tight time frame, everything is it's being exacerbated. So it's even more exhausting than normal. We go to Antonia, who writes, please be aware that many career scientists receive large funding from the federal government that supports their own ability to be employed by their institutions. I think this is probably in response to what Judith was saying of standing up, is my guess, but I'm not positive.
I know that, but I don't care. I mean, this is like, what's more important, getting your kids in private school tuition or making sure that hundreds of thousands of people don't die from COVID? Look, I'm not blaming the career scientists, and I know many are fighting the good fight internally, but this is gut check time. If you work at a federal agency and you disagree with, deceptive information going out, you too have an obligation to speak out publicly. Figure it out. And a lot of these scientists are in unions, and they have protection as federal employees.
Richard writes to us.
That will get us letters.
Excellent. We need more. Richard writes to us and says, we can rally Americans to take on and defeat the coronavirus. Be patriotic. Wear a mask. It's as simple as that. We do welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We have much more to discuss. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Jennifer Burns, and Aaron Pasitti. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to our panel discussion. Okay, deep breath, everybody. Here we go. We're going to get through this story. President Trump pressed his case Thursday that U.S. schools are indoctrinating children with a left-wing agenda hostile to the nation's founding fathers, describing efforts to educate students about racism and slavery as an insult to the country's lofty founding principles. Trump, speaking before original copies of the Constitution and Declaration of Independence of the National Archives, characterized demonstrations against racial injustice as, quote, left-wing rioting and mayhem that, quote, are the direct result of decades of left-wing indoctrination in our schools. It's gone on far too long. The federal government has no power over the curriculum taught in local schools. Nonetheless, Trump said he would create a national commission to promote a pro-American curriculum that celebrates the truth about our nation's great history, his words, which he said would encourage educators to teach students about, quote, the miracle of American history. The panel is the 1776 Commission, which I was interested thinking that it could be called the 1775 or 1778 Commission, given that he often gets the date wrong on the pandemic in 1917 or 18, depending on who you ask. In what appeared to be a bar by the New York Times 1619 Project, the project whose creator won a Pulitzer Prize for its lead essay, is a collection of articles and essays that argue that the nation's true founding year is 1619, the year enslaved Africans were brought to the shores of what would become the United States. Trump said Thursday the 1619 Project wrongly teaches that the United States was founded on principles of oppression and not freedom. Oh, dear. Alan, where would you like to begin?
Well, you know, Joe, the dog whistles here are quite clear. One of them is slavery was acceptable. And who is he talking to? He's talking to his group. He's talking to the people who came out of the Civil War and whose relatives down the line have always thought that the South was right. And that's who he's talking to, and that's how he's energizing his base. And I don't know what else to tell you except that it is something we're not talking about today, depression. And I don't know how he can look in a mirror. I just don't get that. Well, I'd like to go to Jennifer.
Yeah, hey, absolutely.
Jennifer, what do you make of that?
What I make of it is that it's just racist. I mean, there is not. I mean,
it's not even a little racist.
It's just horribly racist and disgusting.
I mean, it really is. And I think what people have to be careful of and pay attention to is really what his motivation is, right? Because, you know, there's a great article that came out yesterday in The Nation by Cheryl Harris, and it is, "What is critical race theory and why is Trump afraid of it?" And, you know, essentially, you know, what Trump is trying to do is he's trying to sort of win back people who have been awakened, in particular in the last 4 months, about the racial disparities in America and the racial violence that's in America, and who have started to embrace that anti-racist thinking, right? That, oh, there are some systemic problems here, and there are disparities that we can see, whether we fully understand them or not, they are there. We can't deny them anymore. And he's trying to win them back by flipping this whole thing to make it, Cheryl Harris's words, an anti-racist movement, right? He's trying to argue here that, you know, by paying attention to these issues of race and sex discrimination and all of those sort of things, that you then are creating a new form of segregation by race. And this is not a new argument. This is something that, you know, began really with color blindness. That's the root of it, that people said, I don't see color anymore after the civil rights movement, right? We don't see it. And then we had scholars who started to look at that in the legal community and say, well, wait, you know, all of the movements for integration, right, that came out of the civil rights movement, actually were still creating racial disparities. And so by not seeing race, it blinded us to seeing the outcomes of laws and actions that were still creating segregation outcomes, right? And so Trump is trying to win back voters. He's trying to pull those people who've said, wow, there really is a problem here, back to kind of his side, or at least to the middle, where they won't continue to point out all of these racial disparities in our nation and these racial problems. And that's what he's doing. And it is racist. It is, you know, his whole idea is behind everything will disappear. That's like his favorite word now all the time. It'll disappear. It'll disappear. It'll go away. It's not real. But you know what? We have to face reality. We know it's real. The talk about racism, the police brutality, the economic disparities in homeownership and economic growth, everybody sees them now. Not everybody understands how they happened, but we see them. And so we can't act like we don't see them, and we can't just say, well, we're not going to look at any of this historical proof that shows us where things may have started and where things may have gone awry and how deeply entrenched racism is in society. Mm. And that's what he's asking people to do. And then he's going to work on education to create fear in people.
Well, it's even worse than that. He's going to take over education and say, this is what I say people should be hearing and teaching, and I don't want them hearing other things that come out of our schools. That reminds me of Stalin, and it reminds me of all the other dictators. That's the and Mao. That's the first thing that they do. They say, I'm going to determine what the curriculum is. I'll write the red book, or I'll write this, and you will suffer if you do what I don't like.
Well, and he's, you know, he's also unaware of how much he doesn't actually know, and not open to learning history. I mean, American history, right? He's not open to an inclusive American history. We remember a few years ago, right, where he talked about Frederick Douglass as if he was alive.
Right.
Do you remember this?
Oh.
Right?
I unfortunately don't think I can ever forget it.
Okay. You remember when they were talking about 619? He's like, what's that? What's that? Right? These are things that have been in schools for 3-4 decades now, right? People know of these events, and the man who's running the country had no idea about them. So he's also basing his directions on the power he wants to keep, right, as a white male in society.
Right.
And that does not mean all white males in society want to do that. But it does mean that he is using dog whistle language, and it does mean he's relying on his limited knowledge of diversity in American society and in American history to make these decisions.
And I disagree. I disagree. I want you to know, Jennifer, with great respect, I think he knows exactly what he's doing. I think he knows what he doesn't know. I don't think he cares. I just think, as I said, I've been using the word evil and devilish lately. He does know it, and that's what makes it even worse.
You think Donald Trump knows Black history or Asian American history or Latino American history?
I think he has a broad view of what it is, and he says that won't help me. I'm going to have to oppose that. I think he does know. I think he is the devil, and as a result of his knowing it, at least broadly, he may not know the all of the facts, but the fact is he knows enough to know that he has to deny it all.
Well, this is the idea of make America great again, right? This is the whole going on to that of we're going to make America great again because we're going to, even though he's going against what he's referring to as a cancel culture, he wants to take and scrub all of that out of our history. Judith.
Well, I don't think this 1776 commission is going to go very far. And I think what it will do in the short term is educate more people about 1619, which, as Jennifer mentioned, has been a really important initiative. And now is a journalism project at the New York Times, really encouraging discussion about the long-term effects of slavery and how it is such a profound part of our nation's history. So, you know, I don't take the 1776 commission very seriously, other than it is definitely not just a dog whistle. It is like a big siren to his racist base. And my view all along has been that Trump knows the numbers don't work for him in terms of winning fairly in November. So what we've been hearing and what we will hear over the next 46 days more and more is this, you know, blatant racism, sexism, anything he can throw out that gets white nationalists to the polls. I mean, that's his agenda for the next month. He wants every white nationalist voting, and that's what this is about.
That's true. But let me ask you a question, Judith. What if he gives his commission the right to say, we will not be sending money to those school districts which we think are teaching the wrong things? You think he's incapable of that?
Well, you know, Betsy DeVos will try that, but most school districts are controlled locally. He might be able to hold back a little bit of money. And we saw this when he and DeVos said that if schools don't open in person, that they're going to hold back federal funds. I don't think they actually did that. There are lots of schools that have not opened in person that are mostly teaching remote. You know, so he can try it. And, but I, you know, I think it's right up there with, you know, Mexico's going to pay for the wall. Yeah. That didn't really work out. Right.
But you said, didn't you, that it may not go anywhere. I think it could go somewhere. And I think there is a lot of federal money involved in education now. States get it and school districts get it. And I think he is certainly capable of saying, okay, you don't do it my way. You don't revise your curriculum. We're not going to give you any money.
Yeah,
I think that that's
your reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. There is a lot of federal money. But if he picks on a school district that rejects this propaganda and holds back federal money, that school district will go to court in a nanosecond and they will win.
And you think that the Supreme Court of the United States, this Supreme Court, will say, oh, well, we're sorry. Maybe he shouldn't have done it, but it is his right. He's the president and he controls the bureaucracy and the giving out of the money.
Well, I'm confused because the federal government has no power over the curriculum taught in local schools. So where would that oversight come from then?
He changes the norm, he changes the pattern, and he says that's the way we're doing it from now on.
And Betsy DeVos sends out a crazy pants memo and just intimidates a lot of school districts to do something they normally wouldn't do. But look, I think if the major thing is, he loses, this whole thing goes away. He wins the second term. Alan's right. He will try his best to intimidate school districts. It's, you know, I have to say, I'm so tired of the dear leader stuff. And this falls right into dear leader. We have to teach history the way he thinks in his unusual mind history is.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more items to discuss. We have a lot of mail, and we'll get to that as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Jennifer Burns, and Aaron Pacitti. And we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Let's see. We have some letters here. We'll go to those first. And we go to Patricia. I think the problem is most Americans do not know U.S. history. I went to the FDR Library a few years ago, and there was an exhibit regarding the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. What a shameful episode in our history. And yes, most Americans don't think about this or are shocked to see the photos and read the firsthand accounts. We are, as a society, quick to celebrate the greatness of this nation and sweep the sickening items under the rug or gloss over and give the most basic facts. That from Patricia.
Including Bill Barr.
Can I chime in?
Yes, please chime in.
You know, I mean, there's an assumption here that, you know, teaching slavery and the internment of Japanese Americans makes up a large portion of public education, and it doesn't. These things get cursory mention at best, at least from my public school experience. You know, maybe when you get into higher education, you start to explore these topics. But, you know, the fact that these things are only, you know, mentioned in passing, it's remarkable how much Trump opposes this, given how little they're mentioned, which is not surprising because he doesn't want them mentioned at all because it's unpatriotic or something. But, you know, I think we need to be realistic in that these are topics that are not really taught in depth or take up a large part of the curriculum in any public school education.
Well, you're right, of course. The question then becomes, why is he doing it, right? I just got a mean letter.
Well, because any mention, because I think this goes back to the, this is what dictators do, and that is any mention of it is unpatriotic.
No, I see it a little differently. I think it all, and we've all talked about this again and again, as going directly to the base. The inflammation of the base. Yeah. You're absolutely right in everything you're saying, Aaron. It doesn't matter. What he's saying is, look, 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 look what they're doing. Terrible, terrible, terrible. And the base is buying it, or a good deal of the base is buying it.
Well, you know, and the fact that the language he uses is so powerful, to say you're unpatriotic, right? If you question American history, if you question how we were founded, if you dig into the truth, right? That's really what he's saying. So to be a good patriot, back to that language, you should want things to be all about the version that has been promoted for so long. And Aaron's right. These things get cursory coverage as it is. So, you know, his base and many others, because I know many people and many college students I work with who, when they get some of this information that I give them to read, say, of course, I wondered what was going on and why things didn't quite make sense. And now that I read this, I get some of what's happening, you know? And so I think this labeling, right? Like, you know, I decided I was going to watch his protest last night, which was painful, because he called it a protest, not a rally. We can't have rallies, he says.
Peaceful
protest.
So this
is a protest,
right?
Right? That whole thing. So he's showing how they can exercise their right to protest, but other people can't, right? So his method is the patriotic way. Others, the anarchists, the left, all those guys, that's all the wrong way. And so I went to his, you know, he's added Caesar Rodney to his list of statues that are going to be in his garden, right, his proposed list. And as I was thinking about his commission and everything else, I thought, you know, maybe you should add Crispus Attucks. Right? I mean, does he know who Crispus Attucks is?
No.
Right? And
well, I don't know. Maybe. I doubtful.
And you don't know your Pete, then you don't know your Pete Seeger.
Right. Right.
You know, and so it's this kind of, you are unpatriotic if you want the country to be more inclusive, if you want history to be more deeply understood, if you want to tell all the stories more often and have it built into the understanding of how we improve our nation, right? If you're a person who is, frankly, non-white.
Right.
That, I mean, that's really what he's saying.
And
that's absolutely opposite of what has propelled us when he then later talks about the civil rights movement and all these things, right?
Yeah, and I'm just, it seems when you look at the, I'm going back to what you were saying about these protests / rallies. You know, I don't know, are those working for him? Are those by going against all of the local ordinances, by putting all of those people in danger? I mean, at some point, does that become an issue? Does it ever does it ever, are you ever able to go back and say, this is what happened as a result of having these events? And more broadly, do they work to change anyone's mind who may or may not be on the fringe to vote for him? I don't know the answer to those questions.
Well, you know, Joe, so go ahead, Joe, please.
When you think about what's happening in America today, you can't have weddings, you can't go to concerts, you can't safely really have a large group in a restaurant. The only big indoor crowd events going on in the whole country is Trump rallies.
Right.
And with no masks and no social distancing. And for a while, they were doing them in airport hangars to get a little air circulation, but they're back inside. And, you know, just remember what happened to Herman Cain when he went to an indoor Trump rally and tragically died of COVID soon thereafter. So I think it says a lot that you have to sign documents saying that if you get sick from the rally, you can't hold the Trump campaign legally responsible.
Well, and also not for nothing, these are being held also in many, many swing states that are also hot zones and hot spots in many parts of the country, Nevada and Florida, just to name two. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alan?
Joe, I just wanted to make a point that I think everybody understands. This election could be very, very close. And the name of the game for both Trump and Biden is to look for areas where you can pick off just a few people or a percentage or two. It's clear that Trump thinks he can bring some African-American votes to his side. And so he does things which I suspect he thinks is going to help him do that. For Biden, he has to do exactly the kind of thing that we've been talking about here today, bring up those things that are endangering people and that might bring a few votes out of a group that traditionally might have gone for Trump, maybe housewives, as he puts it, or others. So that's what's going on here. You have to look at each of the moves by both of these candidates and see who they're trying to drag over to their side of the line.
Let's go to some of the letters that we've been getting on this, and we've gotten quite a few. So we begin with Mark. Even though Trump cannot control the curriculum of local school districts, his racist rhetoric will embolden his supporters in local communities to alter what is taught at their neighborhood schools. This is a step backward to the days when some textbooks actually taught that the South had a just cause in the Civil War. Hope writes, I agreed wholeheartedly with Alan on what Trump is doing. Reading Mary Trump and Michael Cohen's book, he knows what he's doing. All the info is being provided to him by Stephen Miller and others. Harlene writes, United States is becoming a multiracial society. Donald Trump and the Republican Party want to go back to an all-white, male-run society. Many American families have adopted children of color. There are now many multiracial marriages. There will soon be more people of color in the United States than all white people. The white supremacists and the Republican Party want to remain in power and are fighting this tooth and nail.
Absolutely.
Marion says, those of us who are interested don't even know much of what has happened to people of color in this country. How can Trump know? He also knows history from the point of view of rich white men. He doesn't even understand the history of the working class white men he claims to represent. It doesn't matter that it's not the federal government's role. When have laws ever stopped him? If he is reelected, he will be dictating what our children will be taught. He accuses the left of teaching propaganda. He also gives us a clue of what he's about by accusing the other side of what he's about to do. And yes, we do see that over and over again.
Brilliant letter on the money.
Kimberly writes, Trump's intentional ignorance and evil are not mutually exclusive. Both are true. Bob says, can we take a moment to imagine who will be appointed to Trump's 1776 Education Commission? I'm guessing Professors Limbaugh, Hannity, Dobbs, and Ingram.
And Newt Gingrich.
And Newt Gingrich, yes. Nancy says, Trump doesn't want Americans to know about our history. We had the patriotic curriculum in the 1940s and learned nothing about our country, our history of racism, the treatment of Native Americans. Germany has had the courage to teach its painful history about Hitler. Where is our moral outrage? We then go to David, who says, I don't think Trump is trying to persuade anyone at this point or turn anyone who's only recently been thinking about race. It's all about turnout. He's inflaming the base to make sure they vote.
Mm-hmm. True.
Trudaine says that the Hitler Youth and League of German Girls were a device of the Nazi Party to entrench their ideology in German people. Some will claim the 1776 Commission simply a reaction to the 1619 Project, but I suspect the above analog is analogy, I believe is what it's supposed to say. Analogy is a more accurate lens through which to see this latest act. You're all doing an amazing job. Please keep it up. We go to Mary Beth, who said, I listened to yesterday's show with all the horror and sadness and anger that many felt. I had one big question. Where is Congress? How can even the Republicans stand by pretending that the threat to our Constitution is not real? If 45 is speaking openly of staying another term after claiming his victory no matter what this November, they don't have a single thought about it? Are they trusting that the mechanics of changing a constitutional amendment will be too onerous? The latest blurb of 45 about pro-American history curriculum gives me goosebumps. Well, it frightens the crap out of me, says Mary Beth. We addressed the one, I think we addressed the part
we
about
did.
The Republicans, yeah. So I'll move on from that. Suzanne said, when I was learning American history back in the 50s, West Virginia, in a West Virginia public school, all we were taught was glorification of American values. That took a hit during Vietnam, which it should have. It's part of Make America Great Again, which harkens back to the 1950s. Jerry writes, I was flabbergasted to hear Trump's complaints that teaching the truth about slavery and racism in American history is left-wing propaganda meant to destroy America. What a huge dog whistle to white supremacy. Trump wants to continue teaching the Disney version of our history, where Uncle Remus and the slaves lived a happy, jovial life while being cared for by their benevolent owners, instead of focusing on the fact that they were owned. Trump wants us to believe the fairy tale and not look at the reality of racism, which has been so deeply implanted in our country. If we love America, we must focus on our flaws as well as our strengths so we can truly become a country of freedom and equality for all. Go to Susan. We can't give up. Thank you for saying this, Alan. Think of our parents during World War II. We do have to hold our heads up. We have to read the news and write letters and go to peaceful marches and discuss with, not belittle, our neighbors and friends who think differently. This is no time to grow fatigued. I do believe we may be on the verge of turning our country around. Herb says, I believe what's happening to the nation qualifies as a national PTSD experience. Michael says, Aaron is exactly right. Ever since Reagan said that government is not the solution to the problem, government is the problem. Republicans have been working overtime to prove his case. When they screw the American, When they screw the government up, they can say, see, the government is the problem. And sadly, a lot of people have believed them. Russ says, as Trump knows, the chauvinist wing of the Republican Party is still the largest single voting bloc. Biden hopes the demographic shift in this country to younger and more diverse voters will turn out in his favor. Motivating that vote will probably not come from decrying the foibles of the Trump administration. He must make the case that the future can be better than a regime based on retaining privileges. It's a good point made there as well. And Marcia says, I think the Democratic Party should message that the 1776 Project is already taught in schools and is important, but the 1619 Project is just as important for a healthy democracy. Thanks and keep up your great program. We also got this letter from Jane, who said, I'm confused. If Trump wants to erase the history of slavery and oppression of so many in our U.S. history being taught in schools, why then does his base fight to keep up their racist Civil War statues? Does this play into their narrative of white nationalism or just a reminder of their continued domination over anyone other than whites? If we get rid of history, then we should not get rid of the statues? Such hypocrisy. Jennifer?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that, too. We were down in New Orleans when they were taking some of the statues down to great acclamation. I have to say, his base doesn't want those statues taken down because it's racist. I mean, they know what they're doing. They want Civil War heroes kept up there, and they want to continue to do what they're doing. And so the whole issue of the statues is really emblematic of the protection of the racist class in America.
Jennifer?
Well, and we've had, you know, this conversation many times, too, even about the Confederate flag, right? You know, Trump's solution to this, or his offering, I would say, is this, you know, National Garden of Heroes that he's going to create. And really what that does is try to distract people. And then, of course, he signs this executive order, right, that if you mess with, denigrate, do anything to a statue, that you'll immediately face 10 years in jail, right? So he is doing everything in his power to keep the lost cause mentality going, to keep those spatial reminders in place of white supremacy from that era, and to keep his base strong in that feeling that if you take out a physical structure, you're wiping them out. And so all of his conversations are about the left wing, or Black Americans, or Asian Americans, or any of these other people are wiping out all of white people's history. And that's really not what's going on. What people are saying is they're really looking at these statues as symbols of oppression. You know, and there's a very different discussion happening. And the statues are problematic because they are symbols of oppression. And it's one thing to say you want to know the history of what those people did versus I'm going to idolize them. And when you're idolizing them, you are forgetting that what they did was really secessionist, right? I mean, that's what they did. They were willing to fight to maintain, and many of the Civil War soldiers in the South or the Confederacy who were white did not own slaves, which gets us back to the ideology of whiteness and race, right? They believed in the system. They believed in the environment around, and they were aspiring to have that kind of power and control of white slave owners, which were a minority. But yet they were also a majority in Congress and in the White House before the Civil War. So those statues are really perpetuating racism. They're perpetuating white privilege that many poor whites actually were not benefiting from. And so I think when we're talking about statues, we have to remember that what Trump is doing is trying to distract us a little bit also from the other issues that he's falling short on, which is actually trying to improve the country and bring people together. He's just letting it keep divide, and he uses it as a tool to increase his base and then to, you know, play on education and ignore the pandemic and ignore the racial disparities in every area of American society that are really clear and they're part of reality.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jennifer. Let's see. Ralph says, we rightfully learn about the Holocaust in school, but never hear about the genocide committed by Belgium killing 15 million Congolese. We learn about Japanese internment camps in California, but never about Italian and German Americans interned as well. All good points. And we have a letter for Judith that admits this has nothing to do with what we're talking about. I've been accumulating plastic to recycle at the store, but not going to the store. Suggestions to recycle, please.
Well, only number one and number two plastic actually gets recycled. So you should try to recycle that if you've got friends who have curbside pickup of recyclables.
What is in those groups?
Yeah, hard, like rigid plastic detergent bottles, soda bottles. You can flip to the bottom of the container, and there's a tiny little recycling arrow and a number in it. So if it's number one or number two, you definitely want to get that recycled. And I think your friend who has curbside pickup of recycling would be delighted for you to deliver it to them. And then, quite honestly, the rest of the plastics, don't even bother. I love recycling, But plastic recycling has been a total failure. There's only an 8% recycling rate for plastics nationwide. So if it's not marked number one, number two, you know, sadly, just put it in the trash where it'll be landfilled or burned at an incinerator. Pretty bad.
All right.
Judith, I have a really quickly before we go to the break. I have a question about this because I think the pandemic is definitely affecting this in other ways, because I have seen and heard from many people, and in my own neighborhood too, where our garbage people come through and they dump both the recycling and the garbage into the same truck.
Oh, well, that's illegal, and they should.
It is happening all over. Yeah. And I don't know if it's because the pandemic is cutting jobs and all of that, but it is a problem. So I think people
take
need
pictures.
To start to to be aware of that. Really, I mean, no, really pay attention and look out for it because
Thank
it
you.
Is happening.
Yeah, take pictures and call your town hall or county legislature, whoever has authority over recycling, because state law, at least in New York, and I think other states, if your materials are sort of separated, they're supposed to be recycled. This has been a problem over the years, but thanks for flagging that, Jennifer. I didn't know that this has come back. I'll look into it as well. Very bad.
We got something else to depress you, Judith. I apologize.
Okay.
Let's see. We have about a minute before we have to go to a break. So I do want to the next item up for bids here is a talk about aid, the Pelosi and Trump aid talk, as well as federal interest rates. Aaron Pacitti, if I can put you on the spot, and in 60 to 70 seconds, you can tell us about Fed rates real quick, and we can come back after the break and finish that up. That'd be great.
Perfect.
Can you do that in 60 seconds before we go to the break?
Go.
And quickly tell
go.
Us?
No, not 60 seconds.
Not even. All right. You're not even going to take up the. All right.
I have the stopwatch.
Yeah. It's far too complicated.
I could do climate in 60 seconds.
Well, I will throw something out there.
I will just say that this is...
go ahead.
So Aaron can start up fresh when we come back. Yesterday, they, before the House, had discussions about condemning anti-Asian sentiment attached to the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And it overwhelmingly passed to move on, right?
Yeah.
And last night, Trump was already defending his right to call the virus the China virus. So I'd like people to think about that when they're thinking about racism in America.
All right. Jennifer, I owe you. Thank you very much for helping us fill that time. I appreciate it. And within a very important sentiment as well. We're going to come back and we'll go to Aaron. He'll start us off when we return right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel. Why did I say it like that? Welcome back to our panel discussion. I don't know. something. I need a new battery or something. Welcome back to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Heng, Jennifer Burns, and it was like a glitch. Aaron Pasitti, thank you very much for being with us. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Okay. Aaron, the floor is yours. Tell us about, I'm going to put these two together if you don't mind, because we are running out of time as far as have about 10 or 15 minutes. So I'd like to talk about both the news on the Fed interest rates as well, and then you can morph into a talk about where we are in aid prior to the election as Nancy Pelosi and Trump continue, or the White House continue, discussions on a stimulus program.
Thanks. That was a great reboot, Joe, in terms of blending these articles and recharging your battery. The Federal Reserve made a really important announcement, probably the most important announcement the Fed has made since 2008, and that is they are going to keep interest rates lower for longer in order to focus more on generating maximum employment in the economy as opposed to fighting inflation. And I know that's a lot of technical mumbo jumbo, but the Federal Reserve is the nation's central bank. And what banks do is they supply credit to the rest of the economy. They supply credit to households who are looking to, buy cars, buy houses, improve their existing houses. They supply credit to businesses who are looking to expand their operations. So when the Fed makes an interest rate announcement, without going into the details of what those interest rates are, is that ultimately the direction of Fed policy affects consumers and businesses. So when the Fed promises to keep interest rates lower for longer, which they announced 2 weeks ago, it's essentially a very clear signal to the country that the Fed is going to be willing to support the economy using a variety of tools, but predominantly low interest rates to make borrowing cheaper for a very long time. So they had their two-day meeting, which occurs every 6 weeks, this past Tuesday and Wednesday, and they finally committed to a time frame, and that is they're going to keep interest rates low and see no signs of raising them until at least 2023. So the good news is that the Fed is going to be on board in terms of doing all it can do and then some in stimulating economic recovery. The bad news is that the Fed has been backed into a corner in terms of being the only form of stimulative economic policy for the next 3 years, because it's very clear that political polarization and political dysfunction, which normally works in tandem with Fed policy, is hamstringing congressional stimulus packages. So when you talk about macroeconomic policy, there's two arms to it. One is called monetary policy, which is what the Federal Reserve does, and that is controlling the supply of credit. They essentially have their hand on the faucet in terms of how much money they're going to pump into the economy. The second arm, and arguably the more important arm, is what's called fiscal policy, and that is congressional spending and tax policy. And normally the Fed remains very quiet on political matters. They value their independence. They value the fact that they remain apolitical, and their sole legal objective is to promote maximum employment and also stable prices. And they do that in a very technocratic manner. So they stay out of politics. But over the past 6 months, what we've seen is that the Federal Reserve officials have become increasingly vocal and increasingly less subtle when it comes to talking about what's happening in Congress. So what's happening in Congress is essentially a stalemate between Democrats and Republicans regarding the next fiscal stimulus. So You know, in March, Congress passed the $3 trillion CARE Act, which provided direct income support for households and businesses. And you can argue around the edges, but as a whole, that plan was a good first step. But most economists realized it was should not be the final step. So as the summer progressed and as a lot of the provisions of the CARES Act expired at the end of July, everybody was waiting with bated breath, thinking, okay, when is the next round of fiscal stimulus going to come? And with a functioning government and a non-polarized legislative arm, a policy would have been in place to start on August 1st after the provisions of the CARES Act expired on July 31st. But we didn't get that for obvious reasons. We have a Congress and president who don't seem to care about the economy. We have a philosophy that government aid is ineffective, but most people realize that the scale and scope of the pandemic warranted extreme and extraordinary responses from the government. So here we are, a month and a half after the main provisions of the CARE Act expired, waiting for the next round. And last week we discussed the skinny Republican stimulus, which was a almost insultingly low $650 billion, which isn't going to fix anything. So now President Trump has said we should be thinking about a compromise. And unfortunately, that compromise is 6 months too late. Perhaps it's better than nothing, but he's clearly timing this with the November election. So the closer we get to November before a stimulus is passed, the more ammunition it gives Trump to say, see, I'm doing good by the economy. I'm doing good by the American people. We should pass this. And in Congress, Nancy Pelosi is putting her foot down in terms of saying, the House has proposed another $3 trillion spending bill, and that's what we should be talking about. Not this watered down half measure. And how this plays out politically is going to be very interesting and very important with very substantial consequences. As Judith said, the election is, 46 days away? That's another month and a half. So another month and a half without stimulus for households who are struggling to put food on the table, who are making choices between medical bills and everyday living expenses is really important. But at the same time, the political move that Pelosi's making is that, and I don't know this for a fact, this is my read into it, is if she can prevent a stimulus bill from passing, it will inflict a lot of harm on American households and workers. But that should work to Democrats' favor in the election, because Democrats can say, see, the Trump administration didn't pass a stimulus. We tried to work with them, and it's not happening. Now, whether that game of chicken plays out to work to Democrats' favor or totally backfires and gets Trump reelected is honestly one of the biggest forms of political brinkmanship I think we've seen, not only in terms of economic policy, but overall policy in the past 4 years.
I have a fast question. Sorry. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think we're going to see some movement over the next week. Pelosi knows how the game is played. She knows exactly what she's doing. But, in some of these issues, if you had a functioning executive and a functioning government in Congress, which we don't have, it actually wouldn't be that hard. On school aid, for instance, Democrats won $300 right. billion, Republicans won $105 billion. So you split the difference. I think where there's bigger gaps is aid to state and local governments, and Trump does not want to benefit what he perceives as democratic states and local governments. Remember, they have to do a stopgap spending bill because the federal fiscal year ends September 30th. And while people would think, oh, that's impossible, they can't possibly allow the federal government to shut down on September 30th, I would not be surprised if Trump wanted to take this to the brink But I put my money with Pelosi. I think she knows exactly what she's doing here.
I have a real fast question.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
For Aaron. Aaron, at the beginning, the president started to threaten the Fed and threaten the Fed chairman to keep the interest rates low. Seems to me he's won that fight.
Now you really only do have 2 minutes, Aaron, so go ahead.
Okay, I can do that. So remember, Jerome Powell was Trump's appointee to be the chairman of the Fed, which is arguably the most important economic policy position in the world. So he is a Trump appointee. And, you know, 2 and 3 years ago, when the economy was humming along and, you know, you started to see wage gains for minority groups, you started to see wage gains for the less educated, lower skill sectors of the economy. That was all good news. But Trump was still demanding that interest rates be lower, which is, I mean, that's also insulting to economists because Trump thought that interest rates should be higher under President Obama during the financial crisis. So he's clearly using the Fed as a political tool. Given the pandemic and given the trajectory of the U.S. economy over the past 12 years since the financial crisis, low interest rates are our future. And the reason we have to rely on low interest rates from the Fed in terms of stimulating the economy is, as Judith mentioned, because we have such a dysfunctional and polarized legislative branch. So the Fed's asking, Trump is asking the Fed to do things that it can't do, and that is provide direct income support to households and businesses. This becomes largely a political issue, and I am crossing my fingers that the election works out so that we have a Biden presidency, and on January 21st, we have a $5 trillion stimulus bill that addresses things that have been neglected for the past 4 years.
All right, we're going to hold it there. My thanks to everybody this morning for the amazing job that you have done. Aaron and Jennifer and Judith, thank you very much. Alan, we'll be back on Monday to start off the lockbox and the fun drive and get people ready for that.
And that's when everything counts. Everybody's got to be there because otherwise, hey, we're nothing. With you, we could be a contender.
WAMC.org. Thank you, Alan. Thanks to everybody. Be well, and we'll be back right after this.